Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Think of today as the calm both before and after the storm. A break from the craziness of the past couple of weeks and the political and market shocks of yesterday. A chance to take stock, if you will, before Congress tries its hand at this bailout thing one more time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody, as we close the books on the month of September. So far, it's been quite a page-turner, I think you'll agree. Today on Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis that keeps on giving. For weeks, the question has been, what if? What if a bailout bill doesn't pass? That is not a hypothetical anymore. Forget stocks for just a second. We'll tell you how the credit markets are reacting. Bank regulators are trying to do their part, backing your deposits with federal insurance. And just in case, what can Henry Paulson do if Congress doesn't eventually see things his way? We'll get to all that. But first, stock markets bounced back handsomely from yesterday's drubbing, but there are still some problems lingering under the hood. The dilemma is one that's familiar to a lot of us. When you're having trouble scraping by, the more it costs to borrow money. Today, even the world's biggest banks were coping with that problem. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains that the credit markets are sputtering like never before.
Let's carry on with that analogy, Kai. If the free flow of credit fuels the world's economic engine, you could think of something called LIBOR as lubrication. LIBOR is short for London Interbank Offered Rate, and the LIBOR gauge on the flow of money from bank to bank around the world was signaling big trouble.
The higher it gets, the more fearful and more distrusting it implies in the market.
Action Economics analyst Kim Rupert watched nervously today as the LIBOR gauge soared higher than it's ever been, almost three times higher than yesterday. At Merck Investments, portfolio manager Axel Merck fears we'll all be caught in the fallout.
If the cost of borrowing for the bank skyrockets, then it is not possible for them, at least not in the medium or long term, to give you a loan at a reasonable rate. They have to pass that higher borrowing cost on to you.
Merck says the effects will soon begin to hit everyone, from farmers who need a loan to buy seed to small businesses who need to make the payroll. Donald Strossheim is vice chairman of Roth Capital Partners. He warns that Congress needs to race the clock.
It shouldn't take too long, days or weeks, not months, before there is real damage done. If companies can't get the financing to buy inventory to put on their shelves to sell, that shuts the company down in a hurry.
And forces widespread job losses. Already businesses across the country are complaining of higher borrowing costs and the sudden loss of credit lines. One other possible effect, the fine print in a lot of adjustable-rate mortgages uses the LIBOR benchmark. At PNC Financial, economist Robert Dye hopes that doesn't push house payments even higher.
We'll have to keep our fingers crossed and look back at this hopefully as a short-term blip that will not affect mortgage rate resets.
Dye says that could all depend on what Congress does next. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was a rare moment of agreement between Barack Obama and John McCain today. Both presidential candidates came out in support of higher limits on federal insurance for bank accounts. A couple of hours later, so did the head of the agency that runs that insurance program, Sheila Bair of the FDIC. Bair didn't specify how high she'd like to raise the limit. The amount that's being bandied about is an increase from $100,000 to $250,000. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
If the FDIC insures deposits over $100,000, more money is apt to stay right where banks want it, in their vaults. Walter Gerasimovich heads up Metatron Asset Management, which manages big investors' money.
We have a silent bank run going on right now. People are withdrawing assets from banks galore to make sure they're under the $100,000 limit.
Businesses would also like the higher cap. It's a pain for them to split up their money into smaller insured accounts. University of Wyoming banking professor Cheryl Schaffer says businesses like car dealerships need a lot of cash on hand to meet payroll and buy inventory.
And typically, there would not be a particularly convenient way to split that up and still have access to the money for their normal day-to-day cash flow needs.
Right now, a little less than two-thirds of all U.S. bank accounts are FDIC-insured. The FDIC would insure a lot more money under a higher cap. It would need more cash to do that. Banks fund the FDIC through a type of insurance premium. Their premiums would go up, and they'd probably pass the higher fees on to consumers. But should we worry about the FDIC running out of money? No, says Princeton economist Alan Blinder.
The FDIC is sort of standing there now like the Rock of Gibraltar as the only thing people trust. They should trust the FDIC. If it runs through the money it now has, it will get more.
Where? From its favorite uncle, of course, Uncle Sam. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The government's response to the credit crisis so far can best be described as throwing money at it. $200 billion to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, $85 billion to AIG, hundreds of billions of dollars more in loans and credits to big financial institutions. But we got to wondering what else Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke might be able to do in the absence of a government bailout. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
The Federal Reserve, Treasury, and the FDIC have broad powers to lend money, insure assets, and inject cash into the banking system, as they've already done for the likes of Bear Stearns, AIG, and Wachovia. Yesterday, after the House rejected the bailout, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said that help wasn't enough.
Our toolkit is substantial but insufficient.
Still, in theory, the Fed even has authority to do just what the congressional bailout calls for: take bad debts off the hands of struggling banks.
I think there's a limit to which the Fed can do that, because you're almost trying through the back door to do what Congress just said yesterday the government can't do.
Global Insight economist Nigel Galt.
The Fed could offer loans against riskier collateral. Of course, that is bigger and bigger risks for the taxpayer, because ultimately if the Fed makes losses, then the taxpayer would be liable.
The Fed's other tool is to cut short-term interest rates, but they're already so low there's not much power left in that tool, and using it creates a risk of inflation, says former Treasury economist Bruce Bartlett.
The taxpayer's going to have to pay one way or the other, and voting down this legislation didn't do anything to protect the taxpayer. It just means he's going to have to pay in some other way that may be more costly than the $700 billion.
As of the middle of last week, the Fed had issued emergency loans to investment banks and insurance companies worth more than $400 billion. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A quick note now from yesterday's broadcast. It was Republican no's that outnumbered Democrats, not the other way around, on that bailout bill. Speaking of which, 485 points up on the Dow is better than 777 down, but you have to wonder if Wall Street's setting itself up for another fall. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As the FDIC works its way toward boosting federal insurance coverage for private bank deposits, it's worth taking a look for a second at those banks. So far, regulators clearly seem to think bigger is better. Yesterday, it was Citigroup swallowing up Wachovia. Last week, Washington Mutual's deposits were bought by J.P. Morgan. 2 weeks ago, the already enormous Bank of America became even bigger with its purchase of Merrill Lynch. The end result is a lot more of your money in a lot fewer hands. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports on what that means for those banks and what it's going to mean for you.
All this bank consolidation may be scary, but banking analyst Bart Narder says it beats the alternative.
A super bank is much better than a bank that's in business and a bank that's out of business. So it's far better to have a J.P. Morgan Chase WaMu than it is to have J.P. Morgan Chase and WaMu close down.
In that case and the others, the big plus for the buyers is a vast customer base and all their deposits, says independent banking analyst Nancy Bush.
Consumer deposits are the most dependable funding agent that a bank can have.
Consumers get access to more branches and ATMs, but Travis Plunkett of the Consumer Federation of America says consolidation means customers will also be earning lower interest rates on their savings, among other annoying side effects.
They will pay more in the way of banking fees. They will pay more for certain products like credit cards, and overall will not have the kind of alternatives that they have had in the past.
they might be happy to make those sacrifices in return for a feeling of security. In Midtown Manhattan, Jerry McVeigh has just finished an ATM transaction at Bank of America. He says amidst all the turmoil in the banking system, he feels safe with one of the big guys.
You know, it will go down only if the whole country will go down, because it basically represents the whole country.
McVeigh might be right. Now that his bank has gobbled up Merrill Lynch, just as Citigroup and J.P. Morgan are bigger today than they were last month, these behemoths may now be simply too big to fail. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street weren't the only ones keeping an eye on Washington yesterday. Overseas investors were watching our political process, too. They didn't much like what they saw. Asian and European markets were clobbered right alongside their American counterparts. For all its problems, Wall Street is still one of the centers of global capitalism. But days like yesterday and crises like the ones we're dealing with have foreign traders looking for other places to put their money. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
3,000 miles apart, but financially, London and New York are twins. The world's two biggest money centers are in this together. Both are reeling. Both dealt heavily in the complex securities at the heart of the crisis. Stuart Fraser is a veteran stockbroker and a key figure in the City of London Council. He admits that London and New York have both been badly dented.
Certainly, yes, they have been damaged. They're perceived by others to have taken on far too much risk and been too lax about controls. Yeah, I mean, one can only say is that the damage to both of us has been done.
The Zed Yen think tank has been measuring the fallout. Michael Manelli and his team have just produced their latest league table of financial centres. It ranks cities according to their attractiveness to brokers and bankers. Manelli says London and New York are still on top, but a couple of far eastern centres are catching up fast.
Singapore and Hong Kong have risen to the point that arguably within 2 years they could be scoring as highly as both London and New York.
And he says there's little doubt that the turmoil in Western credit markets has given Singapore and Hong Kong a justifiable boost.
Western banking industry, if I can call it that, has grossly tarnished its image. And so if I were in East Asia, I would rightly question whether these people had much to teach me, and maybe I'd be better to start from afresh, creating new models in East Asia, new ways of doing investment banking.
Still 5.7, 10,
30. London and New York still command the lion's share of international financial business. The British capital has 40% of the world's foreign currency market. Wall Street accounts for roughly half of all stocks traded. Some analysts believe that these two giant centres will not necessarily lose that lead.
They could throw it away, but I think if they play their cards right, they can still hold on to their global leadership.
Alistair Milne of the Cass Business School says playing their cards right means not beating up on the finance industry.
So when it comes to introducing additional regulations, restraints on pay, they've got to be very careful that they're not actually damaging business 2 years, 5 years down the line.
The Americans did precisely that after Enron, and it was the Brits that benefited. The US imposed the Sarbanes-Oxley corporate governance rules. That frightened scores of foreign companies away from Wall Street, and they listed in London instead. Broker Stuart Fraser says the UK depends on its financial centre for more than 10% of its GDP. The Brits wouldn't dare upset their international customers.
So there is greater risk, I believe, of much tougher regulation and regulation that could drive business away in New York or in the US than there is in the UK.
Oh yes! Oh yes! Oh yes!
While markets were tanking in London yesterday, city dignitaries gathered to elect a new Lord Mayor in quaint ceremonial style, with three-cornered hats, swords and trumpets. London and New York may be twins, but they're certainly not identical. And the crisis could underline the differences. A more lightly regulated London could even pick up more of the business that leaves New York. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, going bust during an oil boom.
The first call I made when I found out that it was looking like we're not going to get our money was to an attorney. The second call I made is to my bank, and I just asked them, hey, I'm going to have a couple months leeway here.
But first, let's do the numbers. Maybe it was what traders coldly referred to as a dead cat bounce. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But the Dow Industrial surged 4 2/3% today, 485 points to close at 10,850. The Nasdaq rallied almost 5%, 98 points, finished at 2,082. The S&P 500 regained 5.25%, 58 points, ended the day at 1,164. Financials got a badly needed shot in the arm. Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Bank of America all recovered 15%. Tech stocks rebounded nicely. Apple got healthy, up 8% today after Goldman Sachs pronounced yesterday's sell-off of the company's shares overdone. Bond prices dropped sharply. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. The Commerce Department releases the construction spending report for August, and the Assistant Secretary for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Julie Myers, holds a news conference to announce the results of a nationwide gang operation. And on October 1st, 100 years ago, Henry Ford rolled out the Model T. The car sold for $825. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Nothing like a $700 billion rescue package to get those cards and letters coming, and we weren't the only ones getting them either. As we mentioned yesterday on the program, congressional offices were swamped with angry calls from their constituents about the bailout. That public outrage helped topple the bill yesterday, and a lot of people wrote to us to say there has got to be a better way. Eric Carlson is from Portland, Oregon.
I think we need to stimulate the economy through multiple channels, easing credit flow on banks' side and debt relief on the consumer side. On the consumer side, we give directly back to the taxpayer, and the other half goes to establishing a green power industry, creating hundreds of new jobs.
What's happening now in the financial markets is often compared to the lead-up to the Great Depression. There are a whole lot of reasons that might not be a good comparison, but Peter Horwilek from Parma, Ohio, said one lesson from history could do us some good right about now.
I believe that the only way the government can ensure the creation of new jobs is for the government itself to create those jobs. The last time the United States experienced an economic catastrophe of this magnitude in the 1930s, that is exactly what the government did.
At the moment, House and Senate leaders are talking about bringing some kind of package up for a vote in the next day or two. David Franklin from New Orleans says it'd be great if the new plan would concentrate on how we got into this jam in the first place.
While the bailout may loosen up finances and markets to re-stimulate the economy, I am concerned that none of the plan addresses the cause that started the whole crisis. We still have millions on the brink of foreclosure, rates are not low to help these individuals out, and home values are still falling in important regions of the nation.
Larry Brown from Romney, West Virginia, had debt on the brain, and how a lot of it, like we have here, can be a big problem.
When I was a kid, there was a little country called Japan that tried like the Dickens to be like us. They more than succeeded riding high until the bubble burst, throwing their economy into a meltdown. But for the past 20 years, they've been digging out of financial ruin and now have one of the highest per capita savings rates in the world.
If you have a thought yourself about the bailout or about our coverage of it, let us know. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. If you happen to Google the words bailout and blame today, as I did just because I was curious, you got 2.4 million responses. That wasn't quite scientific enough for ABC News and the Washington Post, so they commissioned a poll on the topic last night. Who is to blame for the bailout plan going down? 44% said they hold congressional Republicans responsible. 21% said the Democrats on the Hill are to blame. Commentator and economist Justin Wolfers says politicians from both parties took their eye off the ball.
Like you, I'm angry about the mess in our financial markets. I'm dismayed that Wall Street's incompetent, overpaid, so-called masters of the universe have put us in such a tough spot. But we can't let our anger blind us to the bigger picture. The financial system does something pretty amazing. It converts your savings into productive capital. It's a bridge between borrowers and lenders. When it works, it's a beautiful thing. Your savings are redirected to help young couples buy houses. Entrepreneurs turn ideas into innovations, and employers invest in their workers. The capital in capitalist economies comes from financial markets. Sure, their inherent instability is their Achilles heel. Even so, modern finance has been a steady engine for job growth and higher incomes. Today's problem is that the bridge between borrowers and lenders has washed away. Lenders won't lend because they fear that borrowers cannot repay. Think of the bailout as infrastructure investment. We need to rebuild that bridge. The original Paulson plan was clearly imperfect. Fortunately, political horse trading over the last week had gotten rid of its worst excesses. A good compromise leaves no one happy, and by that metric, the revised plan was a success. But there's an election in 5 weeks' time, and our congressional reps are more concerned with protecting their own jobs than with protecting yours. In fact, the single factor best explaining whether a rep voted against the bailout is whether he's in a close re-election race. It's easy to oppose a policy, but true leadership requires constructive thinking. To those who oppose an unpopular measure, let's ask them a harder question. How would you resolve today's financial mess? Our two presidential candidates understand this dilemma, and despite some false starts, they're going to be part of the solution. We need Congress to be equally responsible. Here's how to do it. Any policy called a bank bailout will fail. So let's call it what it is, an investment in our nation's economic infrastructure. And let's rebuild those broken bridges.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. You can let us know who you think is responsible for the bailout going down by going to our website. That's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. If we've learned anything over the long, slow playout of the credit crisis, it's that there's no such thing as a standalone company. Yeah, on the face of it, any given enterprise might seem to be self-sufficient, but as Wall Street has beaten into us over the past year and a half, it's what you don't see that always gets you. A case in point comes to us from the oil business and a now bankrupt trading company called SEM Group. The firm was caught short when a swing in the markets left it without enough money to cover its bets. Crude margins have only gotten tighter since then, and thousands of oil men jilted in the SEM Group bankruptcy are themselves close to ruin. From Tulsa, Oklahoma, Lori Burkett reports.
You'd almost expect to see cows grazing outside Kevin Cantrell's office. It's in the middle of a green pasture in a small town called Ada, Oklahoma. But Cantrell doesn't raise cattle on this land. He drills oil. So there's another thing you might expect, that with oil at more than $100 a barrel, Cantrell would be making big money. Instead, thanks to the collapse of SEM Group, he's hurting.
The first call I made when I found out that it was looking like we're not going to get our money was to an attorney. The second call I made is to my bank, and I just asked him, hey, I'm going to have a couple months leeway here because SEM Group's stolen my oil and I can't get it back. I'm not going to get paid for it. So
SEM Group didn't send masked bandits to steal Cantrell's oil. When the company went belly up, it simply failed to pay him $400,000 worth of crude.
What can you afford to lose is the question, you know. I mean, this is my livelihood. I've got three kids and my family, you know, that I take care of through this and employees and everything else. So even though we're a small company and it seems like a smaller amount, to me, that's a large amount.
Want to hear a large amount? $2.4 billion. That's the amount SEM Group lost. The company's failure hasn't just swamped producers like Cantrell. Energy analyst John Kilduff said SEM Group also left a stain on the oil market.
When the news about SEM Group's insolvency hit the marketplace, there was first a sell-off and then a bit of a price spike, but we've been coming down in price ever since that news hit the market.
Kilduff says SEM Group didn't single-handedly cause the drop in oil prices, but the fact that it made bets without having the money to cover them panicked the market. Oilmen worried that other companies might be doing business the same way as SEM Group, so they sold out fast. More than 100 miles north in Tulsa, a Conoco truck pulls up to one of Bob Sullivan's oil storage tanks. Sullivan is only selling his oil to public companies now.
We were hurt to the tune of about $2.5 million.
Sullivan says SEM Group collapsed 2 months ago, but the ripple effects through the market are affecting his ability to pump.
The impact on us is that we have to postpone or defer the activity out there in drilling and more oil. It simply slows down the pace at which new oil is brought on the market.
And Sullivan says that's bad news for everyone.
The consumer and the taxpayer are going to have to suffer from our country going out in the world market and buying from Venezuela or the Middle East or wherever it comes from. Those are barrels that otherwise would come from us. It drives up our imbalance of trade. It weakens the dollar. It defers tax collections by the state and the federal government. You know, the trickle down is pretty significant.
A steadily weakening economy is magnifying the effects of SEM Group's collapse. Fortunately for the oil business, demand for crude will probably grow strongly in the future. But it's not clear when that demand will kick in, or whether small producers like Cantrell and Sullivan can hold out that long. In Tulsa, I'm Lori Burkett for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final thought as you get ready for the next news cycle in the saga of the financial crisis, and I'm real sorry about this, but I'm going to have to talk for a second about federal accounting rules. The Securities and Exchange Commission said today it's looking at changes to the way banks are allowed to value the assets they have on their books. The rules right now say companies have to look to market prices to figure out the value of those assets. Mark to market is the phrase. But that can be a tough thing to do with, say, mortgage-backed securities, where the market dried up long ago. Advocates for the change say it's going to ease the burden of some of those toxic assets we've all been hearing so much about. And we will undoubtedly hear more about that tomorrow. But for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 485 points, 4 2/3%. The NASDAQ added 98 points, 5%. The S&P 500 rose 58 points. That's 5.25%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our morning report. Crew, the Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, The Road to Ruin. Our reporters start a 4,000-mile trip around America to find out how the economic fallout is playing out. We'll kick things off in Charlotte, North Carolina, and San Francisco tomorrow. I'll give you a dollar, by the way, if you can tell me what big financial institution those two cities have in common. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for being with us.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.